Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia and Focus newsletter. Kleptocracy is a huge problem in every country of Central Asia. The presidents, their families, and close associates all seem to be living very well, while large segments of the population are at best just making ends meet. Family members in particular, and often family members by marriage, usually own the most lucrative domestic businesses and have substantial assets outside their countries. And none of this is a secret to the people of Central Asia and the international community. The vast wealth of relatives of the Central Asian presidents has been receiving some attention in international media, and a handful of countries in Europe are starting to enact countermeasures. However, the notoriety has done little to curb their kleptocratic practices in Central Asia. Are sanctions a way of reining in these excesses? To discuss all this, I am joined by Eldar Arikbaev, Senior Investigative Reporter and Coordinator for Central Asia at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP. Eldar is also a former editor-in-chief at the independent Kyrgyz news outlet Klop. Tom Main, a research fellow at Oxford University, currently working on a project entitled Providing the Evidence and Analysis for a UK Counter-Kleptocracy Strategy. Tom is also a director at the NGO Freedom for Eurasia. And Tom worked for many years at anti-corruption NGO Global Witness. Laila Saidbak is the chairman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia and a member of the working group advocating for a global Every Woman Treaty to end all forms of violence against women and girls. Thank you all for being on the program. And as I mentioned before, in the first half of the program, I would like to sit stage and talk about kleptocracy in each of the five Central Asian countries, if possible. Eldar, it's your first time on the podcast, so I was hoping you could start us out by describing some of the kleptocracies in some of the Central Asian countries.
Thank you, Bruce, for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be on the podcast. So I mainly focus on several countries in Central Asia at OCRP. To be exact, it's Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and in some parts it's also Tajikistan. So I could speak about these three countries. And I can start actually with Kyrgyzstan because I am initially from there. Right now, what we can see that there is a huge consolidation of power in hands of the current president and his friend, like Sadir Japarov and Kanchi Bektashiev, respectively. And they came to power like 3 years ago after uprising in October 2020. And right now we can see that there are at least like some signs of corrupt activities in their circles, because we recently had an investigation on circles of Sadir Japarov and his son. We can see that they cooperating with this secret tycoon, Habibullah Piqadir, who enabled corruption in the country and who was involved into a money laundering scheme and who built his huge fortune with the help of corrupt officials, to be exact, with the help of the former deputy head of Kyrgyz Customs, Ramzan Matlimov. And now we can see that current authorities cooperating with this tycoon, this Abdikadir. Even though one of the key messages of Japarov, when he came to power, it was to put Matlimov in the prison, but we could see that it didn't happen, unfortunately. He was only, you know, he was fined for some, like, small amount of money, and he also compensated damage to the budget, whatever it meant. He gave out, like, around 24 millions of dollars. But now again, we can see that Japarov's circles, they're cooperating with Abdikadir, who built his fortune again with the help of Matlimov. And we also could see deterioration of freedoms in the country, that almost any critic who is not satisfied with Japarov and Tashiev, these critics are now, you know, some of them, they're facing like criminal charges, and some of the journalists, my friends, they are prosecuted for investigating corrupt activities of Tashiev and Jabarov in the country. And we can see that some like news media, they blocked and like Klub, it was blocked, and now people at Klub, they prosecuted, and the whole organization is now could be, you know, liquidated due to some made up reasons, you know. And, you know, one of the most kind of like famous investigative teams in the country, led by Bolot Timirov, they are also facing troubles with authorities. Bolot himself, he was deported due to his journalistic work. And it's not, you know, it shows that the current authorities, they're trying kind of like to protect themselves, and they kind of trying to silence like anyone who shows their illicit or illegal like actions. And it's kind of like a common thing among, you know, our Central Asian like countries, because in other, in Tajikistan, you couldn't do that. In Uzbekistan, you couldn't do that. Especially during Karimov times, you couldn't criticize the government. And now it's Mirziyoyev, we could also see that there's small, like its situation is better with Mirziyoyev, a little bit, but you still can criticize president.
Before we go over to Uzbekistan, I want to give Lila a chance to talk about Kyrgyzstan real quick, and I'll come back to you in a second. We'll talk about Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, okay? Lila, what about kleptocracy in Kyrgyzstan, which is developing, right? You know, we've seen it before under previous leaders in Kyrgyzstan, but it seems to be reshaping.
Yeah, it seems that the Sadr Japarov and Konshibek Tashiev are consolidating their power and also taking control of the major enterprises that produce, you know, any sort of profit. Most of their actions seem to be aimed at taking control of the sources of wealth. And they also have been arresting the businessmen in the country and confiscating their property and arresting their bank accounts, taking over their businesses. And that really resembles the times when we had Bakiyev in power, because that's what his family was doing as well. His family and the entourage have been consolidating this, you know, economic sort of powers around themselves as well. So that seems to be quite similar. Also, the killings that have been happening and the arrests, mass arrests, basically, they are very similar to how it has happened in during the Bakiyev rule. But I think this time is actually even more severe, I would say.
There we go. Thank you. Okay. You know, and I did want to mention, try to get in all the countries, at least a little bit of stuff, information on all of them. LDR, can you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Uzbekistan? Now, we've heard the name Gulnara Karimova. Of course, that's been out there for years and years. But President Mirziyoyev's two sons-in-law seem to be doing quite well. And there are rumors going around that they're also acquiring many of the businesses in Uzbekistan. Have you heard this?
Yeah. Actually, we were investigating Mirziyoyev family like for quite a bit after he came to power. And again, we looked at our favorite businessman, again, Abdukadir, and we found out that after the revolution of 2020 in Kyrgyzstan, he moved his business to Uzbekistan, and we saw him cooperating with the family. And we also did a huge investigation into his assets in Uzbekistan, and we showed how he was cooperating with Mirziyoyev's family. And what we saw that Abdukadir took over the control of Abu Sakhi market. You know, this is one of the biggest in the region. But he was, and he is, yes, sharing like proceeds from this market with Mirziyoyev's son-in-law, Umarov, and that the bazaar is now under kind of, you know, like, under his protection. I mean, like, under Umarov's protection. This is what we found out during our, like, investigation. And it's not only that, we also saw that this links to the Mirziyoyev family. It helped Abdelkader to build a huge network of customs terminals. Basically, now we can see that Abdelkader controls export and import flows to the country. And we also could see that he is cooperating with subsidiary company of Russian railways and the Uzbek government to build import-export railway routes from Uzbekistan to Russia. And of course, we assume that the Mirziyoyev family, they benefit from all this, you know, deals. In general, we could see that it's kind of a trend in the region, because Mirziyoyev can, like, set it that they are publicly, like, announcing that they're trying to attract, like, different investors to the country. But in reality, we could see that those investors, they are not only some, you know, like, big, well-known companies, but it also sometimes people who made fortune in the region, and they did it in some illicit way, and they hid this fortune abroad, like in the West, and now they're coming back as a legitimate businessman, ready to invest into the country. And this is the case with Uzbekistan, and we can also see that now it's a case in Kyrgyzstan, because Japarov is also trying to kind of, like, you know, mimic his Uzbek colleague.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Lana, you know, I know that you're from Kyrgyzstan, but what can you tell us about Kazakhstan? Let's talk a little bit about Kazakhstan for a second. Any comments about Kazakhstan? And then I'll let you answer that also, LDR. But Lila, can we start with you?
Yeah, well, Kazakhstan is probably the biggest kleptocracy in Central Asia, in my opinion, because the Nazarbayev's elites had a long time to grow their wealth using their closeness to Nazarbayev and his family. And obviously, not only did they make themselves rich, they also made Nazarbayev and his family rich. And many of these oligarchs actually are very well known in on the international arena, and they now do business not only in Central Asia. They do business in Europe. They do business in Africa. They are seen in Latin America. They own companies and assets in UK and the United States. I want to mention one specific company that is called ENRC. It's Eurasian Natural Resources Corporation. It's a very well-known company. The oligarchs that own this company are Central Asian. And the way they have played a big role in Africa, for example, in bribing the officials in Africa, which essentially led to a bloody tragedy in, for example, in DRC. And they are also connected with another very well-known individual. His name is Dan Gertler, and he's sanctioned by the United States, but they continued doing business with him. And these people were investigated by the UK law enforcement, but the kleptocrats are learning now how to stand against, how to fight against, you know, any sort of investigations against them. And they are so successful at quashing the investigations against them by law enforcement. They are silencing the civil society. They're going after the journalists. And what's also interesting, and this is exactly the company and the oligarchs that went after Tom Burgess, after he published his wonderful book called Cryptopia. So it's interesting to see how these kleptocrats have basically destroyed the civil society and free speech in our countries to the point where we can't really work inside the country right now. It's too dangerous. And they are now going after the Western journalists, and they're going after the civil society in the West, and they are attacking Western democratic public institutions. So their legal tactics against the Serious Fraud Office in the UK and, you know, a very wide range of people who had anything to do with the investigation was so aggressive that the 10-year investigation basically led nowhere. And the Serious Fraud Office dropped the charges. I mean, of course, they were never officially charged with corruption. But this example shows of how strong these kleptocrats are becoming, that, you know, there will be a time when law enforcement in the West won't even be able to investigate them anymore. They will be easily controlling public institutions. They will be very successful at silencing the civil society and journalists. So this is quite disturbing. And Kazakhstan doesn't seem to be on its way towards solving this kleptocracy issue. I really don't know the solution to that, to be honest. But any talks about return of the stolen assets really haven't really had any substantial development. There haven't been any investigations into Nazarbayev family's wealth. There were some investigations into some family members, but they seem to be more, you know, kind of politically motivated rather than actually going after, you know, their assets and getting them returned. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say.
No. Thank you. It was good to know about this company dealing with the DRC too. LDR, we'll get back to you in a little bit about Kazakhstan, but I also want to talk, you know, real quickly, because we're coming up to the halfway point. You know, a little bit about Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, because Turkmenistan and Tajikistan their governments could legitimately be called family businesses at this point, right? But LDR, so if you could, you know, say something about Kazakhstan, but also give us an idea generally of the situation in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan.
I completely agree, Kazakhstan, with Leila, but I also like to add that I just like to mention the story that we did about the Nazarbayev assets, and I mean Nazarbayev himself, because it before that it never been revealed that Nazarbayev himself had something. But last year, we found out that he was controlling a huge empire of assets, like worth almost $8 billion. And he did it through a network of foundations established in Kazakhstan. And through that network, he controlled, for example, a British company that in its order, controlled a lot of businesses inside Kazakhstan, like banking, like online marketplaces, mobile operators, like companies in logistics, shopping centers, like different financial services. And it should be also investigated how all this fortune was made and how did it happen to be controlled by Nazarbayev himself. So this is what I'd like to add about Kazakhstan.
And we're joined by Tom Main. You know, Tom, what can you tell me about the kleptocracy in Turkmenistan?
The problem with Turkmenistan, there's several. One, we don't quite have as much information. Obviously, there is some information about assets held out outside the country, but it is very small compared to Kazakhstan, for example, where we have, you know, you could write a whole book on Kazakhstan and assets held outside. Yep, Turkmenistan is run like a family business, and so there would be a possibility of perhaps sanctioning some of the family members, the nephews of Vadim Khmelev senior. One difficult aspect with Turkmenistan as concerns sanctions is that it's very hard to know who to sanction. We know that heads of state aren't sanctioned, so that rules out Vadim Khmelev junior and senior, in terms of government officials who have power, there really isn't anybody who, outside of the president and the presidential family, has power. Perhaps Rashid Miryedov, but as the foreign minister, he isn't really responsible for human rights abuses and isn't known to be to hold copious amounts of money outside of the country. If you sanction a police chief, they're just really going to be disappeared quite quickly. So the problem with sanctions is, barring one or two family members, who actually are you going to sanction in Turkmenistan?
A reminder that we're talking about kleptocracy in Central Asia and also about the possible methods of combating kleptocracy in Central Asia. And my guests are LDR Arikbaev, Senior Investigative Reporter and Coordinator for Central Asia at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP. LDR is also a former editor-in-chief at the independent Kyrgyz news outlet Klop. Tom Main, a research fellow at Oxford University, currently working on a project entitled Providing the Evidence and Analysis for a UK Counter-Kleptocracy Strategy. Tom is also the director at the NGO Freedom for Eurasia. And Tom worked for many years at anti-corruption NGO Global Witness. Laila Saifak is a chairman of the NGO Freedom for Eurasia and a member of the working group advocating for a global Every Woman Treaty to end all forms of violence against women and girls. Okay, we've described what the situation is in Central Asia. Let's see if we can come up with some remedies for this, some possible remedies for this. You know, people have suggested that sanctions could work. LDR, you were just starting to talk about this unexplained wealth. Can you continue with that?
Yes. There are different mechanisms how we could track and see illicit activities, and one of them is suspicious activity reports, which are filed by banks to U.S. Treasury. But we also could see that these suspicious activity reports, SARs, they don't always work because either U.S. Treasury is understaffed and they don't have like a lot of people to investigate these transactions, or sometimes they ask local like banking institutions, like financial institutions inside our countries, like inside Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan, and they ask them if local banks could confirm the legality of the transaction, and local banks, they tend to say that those transactions, that all these millions flowing outside of their countries, they're legit. But in reality, they are not, because we saw that this example of Erkin Saymaki, he was a money launderer who confessed about his money laundering career, and he was laundering money outside of Kyrgyzstan for quite a bit, and Western banks, they filed, like correspondent banks, they filed suspicious activity reports about his transactions. But when they asked local banks if those transactions are legit, local banks, they kind of told correspondent banks that they are okay. But this is not how it should work.
Okay, well, thank you. We're talking about possible remedies for kleptocracy, are sanctions possible? Well, how do you combat this problem, both at home, domestically, and internationally?
I mean, sanctions is a good start, but they are only a temporary solution, and we can get on to why they're temporary in a minute. But I think what's been disappointing from a UK point of view is that we're not even using sanctions. So, you know, we have 200 people slain last year in the violence in Kazakhstan, and not a single person has been sanctioned for that. Now, we understand that you know, heads of state aren't sanctioned, but surely there is a you know, a police chief or somebody involved that we could find to sanction for that very serious human rights abuse. And aside from that, obviously we've got corruption sanctions. We've got Global Magnitsky and the global anti-corruption sanctions in the UK, and they're not being used either. From Central Asia, only Matraimov and Gulnara Krimova, of course, have been sanctioned under Global Magnitsky, and nobody in the UK. There just doesn't seem to be an appetite for sanctions to be used, presumably because Kazakhstan, we have extractive deals, and they're a partner country. But sanctions are supposed to be used on our allies to try and direct them to the correct path to prevent people who have profited from the proceeds of corruption from enjoying those proceeds, but also showing those countries in question that is not acceptable and that they should move away from that kleptocratic path.
Okay, thank you, Lila. What can individual governments do? What can the international community do to try to curb these practices of the Central Asian leadership and their families to bring wealth outside of the country or to amass it inside the country?
So, of course, these sanctions regimes are tools that we really need to be used by the democratic states to curb the corruption. The problem is, as Tom has mentioned, the Western democracies really are hesitant at using these sanctions regimes against Central Asian states. Probably because of the various deals and agreements, and because they are allies, and because there is probably concerns that maybe it would worsen the relationships with these countries. The problem is, though, that these kleptocracies, when they develop and they become bigger and they become wealthier, they use Western systems to store their wealth. And when they bring those, when they bring their money here and they buy properties and they start, using their money on silencing, as I have mentioned, on silencing the journalists and civil society already in the West, and attacking the public institutions, the law enforcement, disabling these government agencies, basically making them unable to investigate further any corrupt deals that they have been doing. And because their deals are, now going beyond Central Asia, they are working everywhere. They're working in all of the parts of the world. So it's the kleptocracy and corruption obviously is a threat, and it has no geographical, it's not a geographical phenomenon. It doesn't really end at the border. It goes beyond borders. It damages democratic institutions, and it is a threat. And we have seen the danger that a kleptocracy holds for the free world. We saw that from the Russia example with their aggression against Ukraine, and that was actually the moment where the world has started seeing kleptocracy for what it is. It is a source of security threat to not only, a region, but also globally. So the question is, and we also saw how the West has reacted, in a very concerted manner against Kremlin, against the Kremlin oligarchs, against the officials in Russia. So we know that it's possible when there is a will. It's not clear right now what is needed for the world to start acting in concert against Central Asian kleptocrats, because we do have a problem right now of sanctions evasion, for example, that has been reported for the past several months. Numerous reports about how Central Asia is being used to evade sanctions, and how it's a huge black hole where all kinds of prohibited goods are going in and end up in Russia. They have been issuing falsified customs documents, that would show a destination somewhere in Central Asia, but in reality, the goods would end up in Russia. It's not only that they are unable to control it, they are also unwilling to control it because this is how they function. These states cannot function otherwise. They function through corruption. They function for corruption. And, you know, it actually influences a wide range of things. And we see that from our human rights background, we investigate the cases of human rights violations. And what we see in our work is that always the violations, any sort of violation of human rights and international norms and abuse, they are always connected to some form of corruption.
And just to jump in, Bruce, excuse me, but I think just to reiterate what Leila has said, and in addition to my previous answer, you know, if we take Kazakhstan, you know, Tokayev himself has said there needs to be a repatriation of money that has been taken out of Kazakhstan into Kazakhstan. And he didn't name names, but he was clearly, you know, indicating members of the former president's family. So the UK and the US can actually help Tokayev in this process. Now, I'm not a great fan of Tokayev, and the system seems very similar to what it was under Nazarbayev, but at least you could show some kind of support to what we take at face value as an honest aim, is to repatriate funds back to Kazakhstan that have been taken out. And you can start to do that by sanctioning individuals. And we know we have countless investigations into Kazakh assets held in the UK. And it's quite frankly bizarre that the UK has failed to act, after, the events of 2022. In this regard, perhaps because of the disastrous unexplained wealth order that was issued against Dagan Nazarbayev that failed, perhaps the UK has said, "Well, you know, we don't want to waste any more time and money on this. It's too complex." But you would think that even with Tokayev saying it, that the UK would be assisting in some way. But as far as we know, they are not, because no sanctions have been issued.
Okay, thank you. We're getting close to the end here, so I want to ask one question, and then I'll give everyone a chance to make some final comments. But my question is, okay, if it's so hard to go after, you know, members of the family of current presidents, you know, all these countries have people that are helping them out, enablers, whatever, that are foreigners, right, actually living in these countries abroad. Leila, you'd made reference to this in Africa, too. Why can't authorities go after those people, the people that are helping them to bring money out or acquire property outside the country? LDR, I'll start with you.
We are talking enablers, right? Yeah, probably we should... I think in some sense we could try to change a legislation a little bit in this sense in order to like prevent all this loyals companies to stop them from helping like corrupt officials to establish like different like shell companies, and I think it's really like difficult to see how it's gonna work like in practice. But actually wanted like to speak also about like other ways how like international community could like stop corrupt practices, and one of the ways is to support local independent journalism and activists in the region, because to impose sanctions, there should be some basis for it. And yes, international institutions are doing like investigations, but it's us local journalists who knows the situation and who could tell the world about violations and corrupt practices of our local officials and leaders. And we also could, also international financial institutions could introduce and enforce conditions to develop transparency in the country before lending money to our governments, because sometimes you can see like ridiculous situation when on one hand we could see like completely corrupt governments like in Tajikistan, and in other hand we could see like international institutions like cooperating with them and giving them money. And there are also like reports of local journals that those money they misused and they misspent.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Tom, what do you think about that? Is that where one of the places they should crack down on these governments is when it comes time to talk about aid or investment or something that should be brought up?
I think I'm going to take the question in a different direction. I think for me, there's two issues. The first is a question of legality. In order to crack down on the enablers, on the lawyers, solicitors, bank managers, you need to be able to show, a predicate crime that the enabler has continued a money laundering scheme, for example. But the issue with kleptocracies is because the people who are laundering the money or siphoning the money are in charge, they have kind of legitimized those financial flows. So in the time of Kulibayev and Nurali Aliyev, they could point to a legitimate signed, sealed and delivered state contract or a loan from a bank with an official stamp on it, which said this is, sanctioned by the state. So it's very hard for the lawyer to say, well, why shouldn't I take this business? And of course, us as anti-corruption experts know that you shouldn't take the money because you're involved in entrenching a kleptocracy. But it is quite difficult to tell a lawyer, don't act for this person when they have, they can point to, a state contract which legitimizes the whole thing. And that is why the global community is trying to look at new bits of legislation, such as the unexplained wealth order, to try and get around this problem of dealing with kleptocracies. But I think there's a long way to go on that. Secondly, is that when criminal activity is discovered, such as with Gulnara Karimova, often the enablers just fall by the wayside. And in the report that Freedom for Eurasia published, called Who Enabled the Uzbek Princess, about Gulnara's property empire, we did name five or six law firms, real estate agents, accountants who were involved in Gulnara's business, unwittingly or otherwise. The problem there we have is that the enablers just don't answer questions. So we wrote to them and they said that, all relevant legislation was followed. And of course, enshrined in the UK legislation is a kind of get out of jail free card. If you are in an industry that is regulated for money laundering, such as real estate, accountancy, and banking and so on, if you file a suspicious activity report to the National Crime Agency, that absolves you of any legal risk when it comes to suspicions of money laundering. You have done your duty. And there certainly is a problem with then the authorities not acting on the information. So it becomes a question of enforcement rather than the laws. Yet we don't know in the case of Gulnara what was done and what wasn't done. The suspicious activity reports, were they filed? We simply don't know. And the enablers hide behind this confidentiality, which actually in this case doesn't apply because the Serious Fraud Office has said that these were indeed criminal funds. So once that has been established, the duty of confidentiality falls away. But these enablers do hide behind that provision. And so we're none the wiser as to what was done or what wasn't done and whether there would actually be a legal case that could be taken up against the people who have helped Gulnara launder money.
Well, thank you. Okay, and I am sorry, but we're running short on time. So I'm going to actually call for everyone to make their last statement, whatever they want to say about kleptocracy and sanctions right now. And I'll start with you, Lila.
Yes, I also wanted to mention what I think should be done to be able to address the issue of Central Asian kleptocracy. What we have also seen in the past in our experience working on these cases is that oftentimes these agencies that try to investigate these cases, they lack funding and they lack people. There was a situation, for example, when I think it was actually in Betty Gaz's case that the investigation was not able to establish the connection between the person who held the assets and Nazarbayeva. simply because there was nobody who could have Googled it in Syria. Like, Tom, am I right? Am I remembering this right?
Yes.
And there were some other instances like this, you know, where very small things have played a really big role in the form of failed investigation. And I'll give you another example. For example, the trio of these oligarchs that I have mentioned earlier, they have spent a total of $500 million on their aggressive litigation tactics against the journalists, against the civil society, against the Serious Fraud Office and the employees of the Serious Fraud Office. Now, obviously, and that was in a span of, let me see, 2014 through to 2020, they spent $500 million. And in just 1 year, in 2020, 2021, they spent $86 million. On this, on their litigation expenses. I mean, this is more than probably any law enforcement agency has across all kinds of different investigations. So often it becomes really difficult to investigate them. And the bigger and the stronger they become, the more difficult it's going to become for these institutions to try and take action against them. There aren't, though, I mean, it's not just the sanctions that need to be enforced. There are, the in Gulnara's case, for example, the real difference was made when official investigations were launched. And we're still, I mean, it's not a quick process. It has taken, 10 years now, right? And the proceedings are still ongoing. So, yeah, I think it's very important to beef up these law enforcement agencies to provide more funding, ensure they have more people and people that really know the subject also. Because this is, again, as Tom has mentioned, you know, somebody who doesn't know Central Asia may just simply not understand when they're provided some sort of a statement from Kazakhstan or from Uzbekistan and to actually understand what that means. So that would be, yeah, my recommendation.
Okay, thank you. LDR, let's get to you. And if I could ask you to keep your comments kind of brief because we're at the 50-minute mark here.
Okay, I think we shouldn't really trust our governments to investigate themselves, but we should support, again, independent local journalism and activists in the region because, again, to impose sanction against certain people or to start investigation against some official on international level, there should be some basis for it. So I think supporting local people, I think, would work in this regard.
Okay. And Tom, I guess you have the last word here for comments. So please.
Sure. So I think, you know, long-term kleptocracy, we need to be more clever about how we tackle it because of this issue of it being state sanctioned. But that is quite far off. We're only, I think, beginning to get to grips with it, you know, with the Russian invasion, seeing the amount of damage that kleptocratic flows can cause. But first things first, we've got these great laws. We've got these great sanctions regimes set up specifically for the purpose of corruption, Global Magnitsky and the Global Anti-Corruption Sanctions Regime. Why are we not using them? Why are we not using unexplained wealth orders? We heard about 100 investigations ongoing when they were introduced in 2018. Now we're 5 years later and there have only been 5 unexplained wealth order investigations, one of which was a total disaster with the Dodiga Nazarbayeva one. So we spend all this time in the UK passing these laws, which are innovative, but we don't use them. Same could be said for the Bribery Act, which has been going 10, 11, 12 years now. We need to use the tools at our disposal before creating new ones, which we do need, but let's just first enforce what we have.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we've reached the end of the program. So thank you, Lila and LDR and Tom. And a big thanks, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Medjlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Medjlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfrl.org. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.